Welcome to the History Tricks, where any resemblance to a boring old history lesson is purely coincidental.
Beckett and I would like to say thanks to all of our micro-sponsors,
including Carolyn, Stephanie, Kathleen, Susan, Laura, and Cassie,
and all the others
who've clicked the donate button on the website at thehistorychicks.com. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And here's your 30-second summary.
A privileged woman born into a privileged family in a privileged society sets out to make her life's work maintaining and controlling those standards, keeping out anyone who she deemed unworthy by crowning herself queen and attempting to establish a peerage of worthies.
The end.
Let's just drop her into history. In 1872, the Metropolitan Museum of Art opens in New York City. Yellowstone becomes our first national park. Victoria Woodhull becomes the first woman nominated for U.S. president. She does not win. Ulysses S. Grant, however, is reelected president. Calvin Coolidge and L.L. Bean were both born that year. And in 1872, the first Patriarch Ball was held, cementing Caroline Webster Schermerhorn as the gatekeeper of New York high society in the Gilded Age. Let's talk about the Mrs. Astor, Caroline Webster Schermerhorn. Now, there is some discussion out there about the correct pronunciation of Schermerhorn. We've chosen Schermerhorn, but Beckett, you did a lot of research on this.
And I called up to Brooklyn and just kind of randomly asked people, so how do you pronounce the name of your street? Now, I will say most fell down on Schermerhorn, so that's what we've gone with. I had Schermerhorn.
Yep.
I had Schermerhorn, which I'm sure is going to make some people's hair on the back of their
neck. That's right.
I'm like, okay, no consensus. I like Schermerhorn. It sounds more Dutch, and therefore that is what we're going with.
Yes. Well, that makes sense because her heritage is Dutch.
There you go.
Her parents, Abraham and Helen. Her father was actually in the shipping business with his brother, Peter. They owned a ship chandlery. Basically, that's a ship store. You know, the ships came in, they needed this stuff, and they got in touch with the chandlery, and the chandlery provided it. It's like the big boxes of our day, only near the docks.
By the time Caroline Webster was born in 1830, the family had become bankers and landowners, mm-hmm. Substantial landowners. So you've got, you know, automagical wealth happening, right. Basically. She's the youngest of 8 children.
She's really the family pet. That really sets a tone for her life.
She grew up like you would think that a little lady would. I mean, there's nannies, there's servants, there's fine clothes, there's European trips, there's $450 million. There you go. She went to school run by a French emigre, and she was taught deportment and penmanship and needlework and dancing. But was she taught academics?
No, really. It wasn't necessary. And she is not the first generation of her family to be brought up in this prestige.
Privilege.
Yeah, privilege. That's actually the word I was looking for. Thank you. Her mother was also from an established New York family. The mother and the father had wealth, and they brought their children up appropriately.
Well, now, they loved France. They actually had an apartment, well, you know, basically a big house, but it was apartment in France. And they weren't Anglophiles. They really were kind of irritated by the British way of life.
The English just were not their type at all.
No, one of her sisters didn't marry until 31 years of age. Some others, you know, 22, whatever. And she, at 25, was not pressured to get married.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, not pressured, but really, I think, in the back of your mind, an establishment is what you need.
It's got to be the right family.
Yeah. And there was a quote that said that marriage to the youngest son of William B. Astor appeared to be acceptable to both the Astors and the Schermerhorns, which does not have the hallmark of a love match.
Not at all, no.
I will tell you, everyone thought they looked so nice together.
Mm-hmm.
So tall, so dark.
And they were both educated. They were both raised in the proper families.
And they had the same social circle.
Exactly. And that's important.
Can I just have one word about the Astor family?
You can have several.
Okay, I'm not going to go through the genealogy.
No.
Because it's a little hard and everybody's named William or John and William John, William and John. So, here's the thing. There's a podcast called The Bowery Boys, and I need you to listen to episode 21.
And you can listen to more episodes.
Oh, yes.
Because they are well established and fabulous.
They are. They cover all of New York history. And so, this may actually kind of spark some interest in other points in which Mrs. Astor lived and moved. Exactly. There's actually a podcast on Delmonico's, which we'll talk about later. So anyway, listen to episode 21, and they've got a bit of the genealogy there right at the beginning of this Astor family.
And they begat everybody.
Yeah, and so, and we'll also put a diagram. It's just really, for us, we can't get it down.
We've just in casual conversation, we've tripped over it a bunch of times. There's just, it's just too, the names are too similar. It's not, and it's not important to Caroline's story.
That's true. Now, I do want to tell you about Grandpa, though.
Oh, I love Grandpa.
John Jacob Astor, the patriarch of the family, started out as a fur trader. Now, I want you to imagine the worst possible Daniel Boone impersonator. And give him a whole bunch of money. I'm not even talking a nice, mild man like Paw Clampett.
Oh, no.
No, I'm talking about if Paw Clampett spit all the time and cursed.
And rude. And, yeah, and all of a sudden, and he makes a wealth. He is what starts the family's wealth.
So he's horribly vulgar and repellent, and he would casually, he'd be at dinner, because you had to invite him. He'd be at dinner, and he would wipe his hands not on the napkin.
No.
Which would be a proper, not on the tablecloth, which would stink, but at least be better than what he did, which is he would turn to the lady beside him and wipe his hands, his greasy, dirty hands, on her the sleeve of her dress.
Isn't that lovely?
And if she didn't have sleeves, on the sides of her dress.
Nice. What? I don't think they had shout back in those days.
Yeah, most of these dresses aren't going to wash.
No, not well. Not well at all.
And so he's not only eating with the wrong silver, if he picks up the fork at all, he's burping, he's yelling down the table. At people.
But he's got a lot of money, and so he's got a lot of power.
So a couple of generations go by, and luckily, everyone calms down, and they kind of polish the image of the Astors up quite a bit. Thank goodness, because how could you not?
Really? Yeah, it's all uphill.
Yeah. That's what my husband and I say is cuter than Don Knotts. It's like, that's not too hard to do.
That's true.
Poor Don Knotts. Okay, so anyway, by the time we get down to Caroline marrying, this family, the Astors, believes in the principle, like it's very British, of primogeniture, which means basically the older boy gets everything.
Everything.
And that keeps the fortune together because, you know, think about generation after generation of 9 kids or whatever, right. And eventually you're left with little parcels of whatever. So
yeah, it gets divided up, it's too thin, it doesn't have as much oomph.
So the key to Caroline Skirmerhorn's future husband is the fact that he is the second son.
Yep. He's
the spare.
The spare.
Really?
And there's actually another son, that Henry, that isn't even talked about. But the two that we really need to discuss are John Jacob Astor III, who is the firstborn, and then the secondborn is William Backhouse Astor Jr.
So if you think about it, William, our William, was the Prince Harry of his generation. I mean, you know, he went to the office because that's what he
had business
to do.
Yes.
He did have business, but he really wasn't relied upon. He wasn't involved in the critical decisions. He was definitely just in the wings in case something happened to the older brother, and that's got to wear on a guy, I think.
No, and his whole life was like this.
Yeah, so the thing is, his parents thought that that marriage to a respectable person would fix him. That's just a recipe for disaster. But so they were married. Obviously an arranged marriage. There was no real sentiment between them.
No.
Although they kept a good facade, you know, for the first few years of their life. For the first about 10, they kept up a good facade.
I think that happened a lot in those times, especially in the social circle.
The two, Caroline and William, had 5 children, 4 of which were girls, and I think they were headed for the heir, too.
They came pretty quickly. They had all 5 of them in 10 years, and they finally got their son.
Boy.
And then Caroline shut off the baby maker.
Well, yeah, you'll notice that's where that all stops. I have the boy, I'm done. I'm really not sure what she got out of this marriage deal, except for maybe having the title of Mrs., and she's the boss of her own household.
Actually, I think it's a score for her. I mean, that's what she was raised to be, and she got it. Exactly what she was raised to be and exactly what she claimed to want. And she obviously will talk about what she does in her life, and she goes after what she wants. So this must have been what she wanted.
Now, I will tell you, the Skirmerhorns were very into, as we talked about, culture, opera, style, the season. And honestly, the Astors at this point, they loved money.
They love money.
Oh, yeah, some money. They liked money is what they liked. So, really, separate spheres started to become the norm. I mean, they diverged completely. It was her job to manage the servants, manage the house, deal with all the social obligations, and honestly, they were just quiet years of
responsibility. Yeah, there was about 20 years where she was just quietly, I don't want to say a homemaker, because she was certainly not our impression of a homemaker, but she just made house. She raised the children and she did all that, those things that you just said.
The two brothers bought houses, understated, but large, understated, very plain in appearance, next to each other on 34th Street, and they shared a garden together. Although the brothers really hated each other.
Yeah, they never got along
very well. The sisters-in-law were very tolerant of each other. The two families had, you know, regular entertainments there, and they were all old New York kind of entertainments. They were always the same and the same lovely people with the same quiet upbringing and blah, blah, blah. It was never known for brilliance or for intellectual fabulousness.
If the dinners were similar to the last dinner that was similar to the one before that, then it was a success.
William began to have a serious alcohol problem, and it got to the point...
Way to put it delicately.
Yeah. It got to the point where Caroline would enlist the help of his friends to keep him at the club longer so he wouldn't come home and embarrass her.
Because he's going to make a big scene, so she doesn't want
that. And yell and stuff, and who needs that? And so it became this conspiracy of keep him away from the house, and that went on for a very long time, in fact. Now, Mrs. Astor's first real new money versus old money challenge was there was a man.
New money v. old money.
It really kind of
is. Yeah, I know.
That.
It is.
It's like the SmackDown.
That would make a great reality show.
I think it is a reality show.
Yeah,
isn't it called Desperate Housewives of wherever?
Isn't that
all new money?
It's not desperate. It's Real Housewives.
Oh.
The Real Housewives of Insert City here.
Are you sure it's not desperate? Because it seems
I'm
desperate
sure
to me.
The desperate one is on Sunday nights on a big network. Real Housewives are on Bravo.
A.T. Stewart was a retailer in luxury goods, and he bought a house catacorner across the street and tore it down and put up what seemed to old New York to be goopy, sloppy, showy, WT type of house. Although, we'll put up a picture. I think it looks beautiful. Which
I know it does.
What about me?
It's a beautiful house, but it's not understated. It's not classic.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
And I will tell you, Mrs. Astor acted like he and his wife did not exist, even though this man had $80 million.
Yeah.
And it was as if, for 7 years, that neighbor had a see-through house. She didn't see it. And his wife, Cornelia, was the daughter of a ship's chandler. Sound familiar? So one generation newer money, just not good enough. You got to pretend that didn't happen.
That's right.
So she excluded him hard from everything, and she actually said, just because I buy my carpets from him is no reason for me to invite him to my house to walk on them.
That's right.
Listen to Tati.
Yeah, well, that sets a tone for her dislike of people who were in trade
for
the rest of her life.
People in Mrs. Astor's circle were irritated at A.T. Stewart because they'd go visit him on business, and he wanted them to take a tour of the store, and they're just like, he wanted to sit at his desk and talk about how awesome his numbers were, or look at this new arrival from so-and-so.
Right.
They're just like, ew.
No, let me
Can you just sign this?
I have many calls I need to place.
I know. So, yeah, poor old boy. See, now we would admire him as a...
building his business, and he'd be awesome. I'd like to hang with him.
So we've reached the year of 1872. So Mrs. Astor is 42. She has got some daughters that are of debutante type age.
She needs to marry him off is what happens.
She does, but Mr. Astor, her husband, has bought a house in upstate New York.
Ferncliff. Again, we're going back to the naming of the houses.
That's awesome. And he has a yacht named the Ambassadress that actually people started to call the Floating Harem.
Nice.
But it was
the largest yacht in the world, and we have a picture of it. There's a very famous painting of it, actually.
So he's gone off to Florida every winter. He's basically MIA, which kind of suits everyone just fine, because at this point he's just troublesome. And when asked about it in public, Mrs. Astor would always say, the sea air is so good for my husband's health. I'm no sailor. I've never set foot on the boat.
Yeah.
Although, really, it's funny because she was outed because in Newport, the young ladies sought after her to chaperone them on the young men's yachts because Mrs. Astor was the only one that could stand the up and down of the smaller yachts and wouldn't get sick. So she was a way better sailor than everyone else.
And I grew up in that area and I grew up sailing, and I've sailed in, Narragansett Bay area before, and there can be some things, nor'easters that pop up, and it's pretty choppy. So she had no problem.
So Mrs. Astor looked around, and she kind of felt that society was contaminated. Well, and if you think about it, all of the people from, Ohio and Washington, D.C., and they got some money.
Oh my gosh, perhaps Kansas.
Ew. And then they got some money, and where did they all want to head? To New York City.
Of course.
Because that's where it was. But all these riffraffs coming and with new ideas and new cultures, and they didn't know our ways, and she was really disturbed.
They are not our type, dear.
No, not at all. Now, this is an era that Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, and what that means is, think about what a golden age is, a golden age of intellectual blossoming, a golden age of economics, a golden age of cultural heritage, or whatever, but this is not, in fact, golden, this is only gilded. Gilded meaning gold paint has been applied to crap, basically. And so Mark Twain, you know, obviously that's not complimentary, a gilded age. We think it's fancy.
But I know, it sounds really very fancy, but it's not, no.
Mm-mm. It really means a lot of glitter on the surface with not a whole lot of substance to it, which is really kind of what happened. So right about now, she meets her partner in crime, I should say. His name's Ward McAllister. We're going to talk about him a little bit after the break. We're just introducing him now. Remember Dr. How from Helen Keller, who taught Laura Bridgman?
Okay, every time you say Dr. How, I always think of Dewey Cheatham and How. Okay, go on.
From Dickens? No. That's what it sounds like.
No, from the Three Stooges.
And our levels have been established.
Okay. Anyway.
It sounds like a Dickens. Okay, whatever.
Enter. Ward McAllister.
Ward McAllister was Dr. How's wife's cousin. This is all I was saying. Is there's a 6 degrees of separation thing. Long ago. Like,
yes.
15 minutes ago. That's what I was trying to say. Okay, so some say that Ward McAllister was the eminence grease, which basically means the man that did all the dirty work.
Right.
And some say he's a trained monkey. So we'll explore that relationship right after the break.
Back. New York City is being overrun by new money social climbers. Our girl Caroline, who actually is called Lena. We don't like to call her that because we're just so formal here at the History Chicks. But since she was a child, she was called Lena. That was her nickname. So Lena, Caroline, okay, I can't call her Lena. She can't have her New York society run over by these newcomers, these upstarts. They don't know our ways. And plus she has to find her daughters a husband. So enter Samuel Ward McAllister. Now this gentleman is, he came from a money family in the South. He's a lawyer and his family was a judicial heritage. He's actually married, but we don't really hear too much about his wife, Sarah.
She's the real money.
Yeah, she's his backer. But you don't hear a whole heck of a lot about her. Ward has traveled all over Europe, and he has studied nobility. He has studied their mannerisms, their discussions, their talk. He is obsessed by society and wants to infiltrate the New York society, and he's successful because he is, as Beckett has so cleverly put to me in the past, super snob, 3000.
He is. The thing is, he got exposed to this kind of society in the 1850s, and then when he shows up 20 years later, he has nostalgia for the good old days when everybody knew who was who and everybody knew what was what, and it's like nostalgia for the 1950s now.
Right.
You know?
Oh, he totally glossed it over.
And oh, yeah.
He saw it the way that he wanted it, and he saw an entree into society through several. Actually, he hung with several people in Caroline's world.
I think Mrs. Astor won for the main, well, there were two
main
reasons.
There were a couple reasons, yeah.
She had the right temperament or whatever, but another thing is she had an absent husband.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mamie Fish's husband, Stuyvesant Fish, hated Ward McAllister. Mm-hmm. Thought he was a little toady, dirtbag-like guy. And so, you know, it helped a lot that Mr. Astor was just gone.
And Caroline needed an escort.
Yeah.
So Ward was more than happy to provide his I don't want to say services, because it really wasn't that type of relationship.
Oh, no, it's not romantic
at all. It was all business.
So he was a clever outsider, but not that much of an outsider. He's been going to Newport, in fact, since the 1850s. He used to rent sheep to give his parties atmosphere, which is like bleh.
Sheep?
And he's been...
Wait, did you just say rent sheep?
He would rent, like, washed and brushed sheep to wander about his picnic area.
I see.
Yeah, so anyway, he's not...
charming. He must have seen that in a painting.
Yes, yeah. And he spent an inordinate amount of time studying sauces and things like that.
Sauces. His mind sauce king.
Yeah, his mind for detail is kind of sick. Really, but...
Well, it's a thing. I mean, we all have our things.
Yes. In London, there's an assembly called Almack's. And any reader of Regency romance novels will know what Almack's is. It was run basically by three women who would determine if debutantes and their families were respectable enough to receive tickets to these balls. That was the marriage market. It couldn't be more clear.
Right.
That their job was to prevent something nasty being fished up off the bottom of the ocean to be presented to these young girls.
Well, that solves a problem for our friend Caroline.
He wanted to create that in America, and so...
And Caroline wanted to have an exclusive group of people that she not only socialized with, but within which her daughters could marry and create new generations of privileged society, well-bred bulls.
So the patriarchs were born. This is still 1872, and what she said was, what was needed was for men of wealth and good family to take more seriously the responsibilities of their social position. And so 25 prominent men were chosen by Ward McAllister and a committee of two others, because he had that Almack's model in his mind, and he wanted, you know. And of course,
two other men, not Caroline.
Well, and they talked about that. They talked about that, and men have this distressing tendency at this time to give people the benefit of the doubt and invite them places. Where the women wouldn't want to receive them. And so they thought that the only people that could hold rich men in check were other rich men and the approbation of other rich men. So they thought it better just be the men running it. They thought that would be a better outcome.
Right. And okay.
It was manipulation, though. Seriously. Yeah. It was like, you really think you're the boss?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Caroline's finger is all over the list. Absolutely.
So they were allowed to invite four ladies and five men to each of these balls, which always happened in the winter.
Right. That's the New York society season is the winter. Yep. In the summer, they went to Newport. That's whole group of people flocked back and forth. But the New York society season is winter. So they had the balls in the winter.
At Delmonico's. And interestingly enough, one of the patriarchs, Archibald Gracie, actually started the fad for Delmonico's before the patriarchs by having debutante balls there.
Mm-hmm.
That was the respectable place to bring your daughters out.
So it would make sense that that would be the respectable place to hold the patriarch balls.
That's right. So the purpose of this whole strategy is that it was designed to bring an end to the social republic that they thought was horrible, this whole free-for-all, and to bring an aristocratic social order. You know, the British have a social order, and it's called the peerage, and everybody knew where everyone stands in it.
And we'll talk about peerage when we discuss more about the Gilded Age heiresses, but yes.
They actually did a junior version called the Family Circle Dancing Class. And it was basically just the junior patriarchs. All the children of the patriarchs and friends went to this. And Ward spent many mornings that he complained of, but I think he secretly loved receiving crying mamas weeping at him about they didn't get an invitation.
Right.
And he would say things like, I'm only the servant, madam. I will do my best. I am not the decision maker. I serve those who decide or whatever. Smarmy.
How do you cry to this guy without... like, wanting to throttle him.
He had this vision of himself as a creator of men or whatever, and I think a lot of people saw him basically as a capering little monkey with a hat on by the side of Mrs. Astor. So, yeah.
And yet they're begging for invitations. So
he's the gateway.
Well, I mean, it makes sense to have these junior balls, because then those kids grow up together, and who better to marry than your best friend since junior ball days?
So we've seen this before, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Do you believe we saw it at Versailles?
Yes.
With Marie Antoinette.
What you do is you make a lot of complicated rules.
Mm-hmm.
You make plebeian things honors.
Mm-hmm.
Like the honor of going in a room with the same people that were at the ball last time and seeing the same people and dancing the exact same dance again. That's such an honor. And you make the numbers really small and people will fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very psychologically clever of
Yes. Them. Oh, it sure is.
Now, here's how a typical ball would go. At 10 p.m., this is at the beginning now. They got a little later in the decades. But at 10 p.m., the evening began. There were always two orchestras at Mrs. Astor's and the Patriarch's balls, so that there was never a break time where the orchestra had to take a lunch break or whatever.
Because you always need music to listen to, because otherwise you'd have to
talk to each other.
Imagine!
And, yeah, the conversation was not very intellectually stimulating. So you began with the waltzes, which a generation ago had been scandalous, by the way. Okay, so they would start with a quadrille after that called, and the favorite was called The Lancer, which is basically in those high school movies at prom where everybody gets in the middle of the clapping circle of people, and, you know, and everybody, all the couples get their chance to rock out.
Right.
That's kind of what The Lancer was, it, you know, just to put it mildly.
Without the grinding.
Oh, yeah, certainly. At 11 p.m., you have ices and kind of light snacks were set out. And then at 12:30, there was supper. And this was a grand affair. And sometimes it was a plated dinner, and other times it was a buffet.
Mm-hmm.
But both times, there was a great emphasis on expressing the knowledge that you had a bunch of people working on this food, because it was all very elaborate.
Yeah, very elaborate.
After supper, which we'll talk about the menu in a minute, there was a dance called the German, or the German Cotillion, not capitalized, just the German, and it was 50 to 100 couples in a ritualized dance that was kind of like a square dance. There was a caller, and...
kind of like a square dance, and yet, no, not really.
No, not really. Any number of things could appear in the German, and if you had a skilled MC, you could end up... I mean, there were things where every lady would have like a handful of glittery dust, and at a certain moment, she would let it go in the air, or there were fans given to people, and you would tap your partner.
So kind of like watching Rocky Horror.
Interesting, I don't know. But there were times that favors were given. Golden bracelets for the ladies.
Yeah, they're not throwing those in the air.
No.
No. But that's a nice favor to bring home.
The whole dance sounds very interesting. I looked it up and I found some videos of some recreations of several of the dances. Now, I found a recreation of one dance called the fan dance. Now, this could get out of control if you got the wrong person, so it was important to select the correct MC.
Mm-hmm.
So, no kookiness.
Because I would imagine that if they got kooky, that MC would not be asked to return.
Yes. So, in association with Mrs. Astor's, often mentioned the number 400.
So where did the 400 come from? There is a couple versions out there. One says that Ward had said that that is how many people will fit into Mrs. Astor's ballroom, and that is not correct. It came from, actually, it did come from Ward, and he did say there's only about 400 people that are comfortable in a ballroom. He said this comment off the cuff, and the number is actually very close to 400, so the man knows his sauces and he knows his numbers of people, because he pinned it. It was about 400 people. It was in the 300s, but...
My favorite part about that quote is that he said they're either not at ease in a ballroom or else make other people not at ease. Well...
I'm fairly certain I would make other people not at ease in a ballroom.
No, we are going to post this menu from one of Mrs. Astor's balls. It's all in French, of course. This is a buffet. There's hot service and cold service, and there is one in particular called a chaud froid,
which sounds so nice until you read what it is. And what is it, Beckett?
Well, basically, they've taken thousands of little quails and roasted them, just like you would roast a chicken, you know, the little roasted chicken, sealed them in aspic, and then done clever things to their heads where they removed the eyeballs and replaced them with egg white, and then they reattach the heads, and then they decorate the body as if it still had feathers.
Hey, I don't want that much fussing with my food.
And it's all that fussy. That's the funny thing. And there's easily 7 kinds of desserts here. Any amount of work that went into something just to show that you had a guy and a team that could make this kind of stuff, it's amazing.
All the touching of my food.
Well, and there is a serious lack of vegetables. And which is interesting because there's things like potatoes, of course, you know, that was very common, but on hominy. But other than just a very few vegetables, raw vegetables were thought to be terrible for the digestion, except for celery, which was seen, which is very raw on your digestion.
Oh, yeah.
But it was seen as, you know, high class. But vegetables were rare vegetables, is what they called them, were not seen as very healthy for you.
That's something.
Isn't that funny?
As a low carber, I'm thinking you're not doing too much of this.
As a low-carber, I'd be great. Meat. I just have to avoid the dessert, of course.
A little pate. Yeah. Salad orientale, we don't really know what that is.
It could be anything.
Anything.
But yeah, I've translated what I can of all this, and so you'll have to see. And even cooler, the New York Public Library has received a donation very recently of 25,000 vintage menus from restaurants.
This is so cool. We will totally put this link on the website.
And they need your help.
You need to go. We have done our time. Now you go do yours.
They need people to transcribe, not translate. So you don't have to know any foreign languages or anything. You just have to know how to read, really. They've scanned all their menus, and they're putting them up, and you just click and translate for them, and they are aiming to create...
Transcribe, sorry.
They are aiming to create a database of vintage menus. They're all from around this time period, and they've got prices on them, too. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Culturally, it's very interesting to read through the menus.
And if you don't even feel like doing it, just go look at them. It's so neat to have come across that, and it's so recent, and lots of people are starting to jump on the bandwagon. If you'd like to be a part of history in that way, we will give you the link to that.
Do it.
It's quite awesome. There's also another recipe site I found called vintagerecipes.net, and so if you want to make some of these things, maybe not the quails.
No.
It's a little out of control.
No.
But, you know, there's salmon with sauces, and, you know, meat with sauces, and how do you make petit fours, and all that kind of thing, so... There's somewhat reasonable things on that website if you have some time and
like to mess around in the kitchen.
So that's really good.
We won't be giving you one of those blogs with us making it, however.
No, I think that would be a bad plan.
No.
No, a quick word about clothes.
A quick word. You want us to have a quick word about clothes.
No, we'll cover the more
okay.
clothes. We'll cover more clothes in the next podcast, but Charles Worth was the man to be seen in.
Yes, he was designing on both sides of the pond. His clothes were being seen. And that's what you wore to one of these balls.
Now, back in the olden days, when the Knickerbockers and the old New Yorkers ran things, one would receive your Worth dresses, and they would come in a big box with, hard to explain, almost like seatbelt material crisscrossing inside of the box mm-hmm. with the dress resting on it. It was like a shock absorber, so
right.
it wouldn't crush the flowers or the ruffles or anything. And immediately, you had to shell out a 50% tax on top of what you paid. Now, the upper end of this dress was $60,000 that you have paid. So, basically, $90,000 for this dress. Could be, on the upper end. The lower ones were $16,000. So, that's some kind of permissive papa or husband to be shelling out this money. But I guess if you have $450 million.
And you wear different dresses.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
They were meant to be worn a couple times and then set aside.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps saved to be made over for a daughter, but you wouldn't wear the same dress again.
No.
I think it's so funny that in these days when they're eating 4,000 calories a day, that they are cranking their waist so hard.
So tight, yeah. Well, they're just taking all the stuff that's in the belly and they're pushing it down.
Well, thank goodness for the bustles, I guess. Back in the early period, you would set aside your dress for a season so it wouldn't be too new or
right.
too trendy or whatever. But by the time the 1880s came around, everyone's like, whatever, I got a new Worth dress, let's haul it out.
Yeah. And right out of the crate.
Yeah. Let's talk about houses just for a bit. Once again, something else that'll appear next time. Newport, for generations of Skirmerhorns in particular, was the summer escape.
Mm-hmm.
It was cooler there. The breezes were more salubrious, and there was sea bathing, which we'll have to talk about next time, too, which is comedy. Wear 50 pounds of clothes and get them
into
wet.
Into the water, yeah.
yeah.
Into the ocean. It's not even like stepping into a pool.
And I have to tell you, I lived right there, and it is... Thank goodness, because I was freezing the whole time. So maybe if you had 50 pounds of clothes on, it was tolerable, because I couldn't stand it. Now, Mrs. Astor's Beechwood, which is her house, you can still see it, but up until recently, it was an awesome living history museum.
Mm-hmm.
If you came in the wintertime, which was not the season for Beechwood, you know, if you came in the wintertime, the actors who played all the parts would act like they were interviewing you to be part of the staff, like you were an applicant. And they would show you the servants' quarters and the kitchen. And if you came in the summer, they would greet you as an honored guest of Mrs. Astor. And that's how the play would play out. Now, unfortunately for living history, someone has bought it to live in. For the knockdown price of $10.6 million.
No.
Which for Newport is chump change.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, I guess. I don't know. I haven't bought a mansion in Newport.
I'm just saying.
I think the price was very reasonable. I mean, it is this economy.
So you cannot tour it anymore. That's a real loss, because that was a great tour. But I will tell you, as a substitute, the Elms. Go to the Elms and call ahead and get the servants' tour. I can't remember. I think they call it the backstairs tour,
mm-hmm.
but take it first. Take the backstairs tour first. Reserve ahead of time, and you get to go through the kitchen. You get to see the pastry chef, who was just in the middle of the basement, all these turning hallways, a whole marble room all to his very own. He was probably completely crazy. But they had to keep the pastry cold, and so he was really secluded from the ovens and everything. It's amazing. You get to see all the stairs the ladies had to go up. The servants had to go up hundreds of stairs just to get to bed.
Well, maybe that's how they worked off those 4,000 calories.
I would say you can eat 4,000 calories if you're working hard like that.
Or
if you do the coal trucks. You can see the coal trucks where the guy would go to the coal trucks and push them by hand all the way down these train tracks into the house.
Crazy.
It's so cool to see that. And then take the regular tour, and you'll appreciate it far more.
And we will link you. There is a website, all the tourable mansions of Newport. There is an organized website. So if you can't get to Newport, which a lot of us can't, you can at least do things online. And I did find another website that has, which I will link you to, which has the floor plans of the Astor's house and several. It's Gilded Age architecture is this guy's passion. And it's a pretty cool website to peruse. And for this time period, this is his thing. And he does it very well on the site, so I'll link you to that.
Alongside all of the Delmonico's activities and the private house parties that were going on with the 400 was a parallel society called the Bouncers. Well, they didn't call themselves the Bouncers.
No.
The 400 called them the Bouncers, or their Arrivistes.
Speaking French.
Basically, you know, the new people. And they would have dances, too, and it wasn't actually so exclusive, because the 400 would be invited and attend these balls, mm-hmm. but the reverse was not true.
No, it was not.
Until the turning point started to happen when the Bouncers started to gain a little ascendancy. You know, we've had our 11 years of old money bliss,
mm-hmm.
and now the ultimate Bouncer has raised her head for combat.
And that would be Alva Vanderbilt. Now, the Vanderbilts are pretty wealthy people at this time, but they are new money, and Caroline wants nothing to do with them. Now, a lot of what you read says that she snubbed the Vanderbilts, and she snubbed Alva. One of the books that we will recommend has a picture on the cover of Alva standing right next to Caroline at a social event. So they did go to the same. They weren't besties by any stretch.
No, and you know, the old story, which is largely true but has been really amped up by the press, I think. The famous story is that social climber Alva built a new French-style chateau on Fifth Avenue, and everyone was gaga to see what was going on. Poor A.T. Stewart was just ahead of his time, wasn't he? So everyone was so interested in what it was going to look like. All these interestingly colored boxes were going in, and all these statues were being carried in.
Exterior is very opulent. It's very French chateau.
And so, Mrs. Astor plans a great ball to open the house. And Carrie Astor and her little friends. Carrie is the fourth daughter, the youngest daughter of Mrs. Astor. Carrie and her friends have been practicing a little dance to perform for everyone, and they've gotten someone to make these electric star headpieces, and they light up. This is amazing. It's 1883, and we've got electric lights on our head. Isn't that interesting?
That is cool.
That we dance with.
And later, after this period, some of the gowns had equally fascinating electric pyrotechnics that went on in the gowns.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So she's practicing this little dance, and Mrs. Vanderbilt puts on this sorrowful, I'm so sorry, Miss Astor. I cannot invite you without your parents and your mother, who is my social superior, has not yet recognized me, so I cannot invite your family.
And this is going back to the calling card thing.
Yeah,
calling cards. This is part of the complex rules that Caroline helped establish. And her own rules are biting her in the fanny. Because she has to, as Becca just said, as a social superior to Alva, she has to come and leave her calling card at Alva's house and acknowledge her presence, which has not yet happened, which is what Alva is waiting for.
And, you know, how could you have your poor little daughter miss? It's the event of the decade.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's going.
Yeah, everyone's going. And so Mrs. Astor did call. That is a historical fact. But, you know, some of the Astors had been at Alva Vanderbilt's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't snubbed the same way that the Stuarts had been snubbed. They'd been guests at Patriarch's Balls, mm-hmm. too, repeatedly. Mrs. Astor was often in the same room. Now, that doesn't mean that they spoke, really.
No.
But they were on the same committee together to build the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty, which was pretty cool.
Very important.
Okay, so after this event happened, this could be a face-saving comment, but Mrs. Astor says, "We have no right to exclude those whom the growth of this most great country has brought forward, provided they are not vulgar. In speech and appearance, the time has come for the Vanderbilts."
Yeah.
That sounds like some face-saving to me, but
a little backpedaling, and I love the way that she leaves in a loophole. Provided they aren't vulgar. Oh, okay. Who decides that? That sounds a little subjective, but okay.
And then the new money strikes another blow, because 2 years later from that, the old Academy of Music, there are boxes to be seen at the opera. There's a finite amount of boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And
the opera is a big part of their society. That's where they went before they went
to the patriarch balls.
And that's why the dances always started so late. One must appear at the opera. Poor opera singers, though. I don't think anyone paid one bit of attention.
They were too busy looking at all the other boxes.
I know, and that's where you were to show off your wealth. I mean, there's no sense having these fancy dresses if no one sees them. Mm-hmm. And so...
Like the fancy dresses that we're wearing right now.
I have pearls on my shirt.
I know, I see that. That's really
okay, well, that's as far as I go. But, at the opera, just like Land, they're not making any more of the boxes. They are a finite number of boxes in this old Academy of Music, and New Money just said, just sidestepped. Okay, they built a new opera house.
Ta-da!
They built a new opera house with 90 boxes, which ended up being way too many, and they took the third tier down because it was embarrassing that it was empty. You know, third tier. That's, we can't have that. So they actually ended up deconstructing the top tier. So they had 60, which was more than enough. Mm-hmm. But that was so glittering with wealth and just money from every corridor, they started to call that the Diamond Horseshoe. The two rows of, the two tiers of boxes were the Diamond Horseshoe. Yeah, so there's finally room for everyone. So thanks, New Money. Thanks for making that happen.
Yeah, appreciate that.
And all these things used to become the property of some sad little reporter that was pushed to the side. Society reporter, whatever, you know. But this is the era in which this society reporter became FAMU. Yes, this society reporter...
They went all out, and they reported on the events, and you can, we'll link you to at least one of them. You can find the rest of New York Times reports of these, of patriarch balls.
Yeah, descriptions of clothes, and the food, and who was dancing with who, and are there European nobility present?
Yes.
Because there were, because people's daughters started marrying British nobility, mm-hmm. and then we'll talk about that at the next podcast.
And it wasn't, in the at the Patriarch's Balls, it wasn't just the 25 plus their 9 invited guests. There was visiting dignitaries could come, debutantes from other towns, cities, mm-hmm. who were being received in New York, they could come.
So the upper classes began to get wise, and they fed information strategically to the press. And this helped the paper... Because the middle class was consumed with copying the details of these balls for themselves. How fast were their knockoffs of the Duchess of Cambridge?
Yes.
This dress from Issa. That's right.
Right. I mean, within hours.
Yeah.
And I have to say, can I just take an aside because we like to talk about fashion? How thrilled I am that she wore sleeves. I know it was proper for Westminster Abbey to have sleeves on your dress. But now, because Catherine wore sleeves, sleeves will be coming back. Because there are a lot of brides out there who really should not be wearing strapless gowns.
There you go.
So I, for one, am saying thank you. Thank you, Catherine.
Well, the advertisers love this, too, because they got to the jewelers, the florists, mm-hmm. the decorators. Society coverage began as respectful, even toadying, kind of. But soon there was a man named Mr. Man. I swear that's his name.
Okay, I believe you.
And he had a column called The Saunterer, and he started to kind of expose what he called the foolishness. He wanted to out the expenditures. He found the tackiness.
He was like the Paris Hilton of his time, yes? You know that guy?
Yeah. I think it is, like Perez Hilton.
Yeah.
Yes.
The blogger.
But except for he had a blackmailing streak in him, and I can't speak to Perez Hilton. I don't know if he's got this in him, but Mr. Man used to write these scandalous articles and show up at the Gentleman's Club waving it and saying, I would love to publish this unless there's some, and he would hold out his other hand silently. Yes. And he was not averse to publishing things. If people didn't pay, well,
that's goodbye. Blackmail, pure and simple.
And he would say things wantonly for no money. Call, like, Mrs. Bradley Martin was so ablaze with diamonds from head to foot that she looked like a dumpy old lighthouse.
I mean, she looked in the mirror and she didn't feel the dumpy old lighthouse.
But maybe she did after she read that in the paper.
I know,
she started to doubt herself. So, Mrs. Ouster, he described as a vain and jealous old lady. So, 1890, old Ward McAllister, in bed with such people as Mr. Mann, not literally, but, you know, he was feeding them details because he was an insider.
Mm-hmm.
He made a big mistake.
Big mistake. He writes a tell-all, and it's called Society as I Have Found It, and it is actually online, and we will link you to it.
Yeah, and name no names, really. Mm-hmm. No. Although you knew who was who.
It was pretty obvious.
It seemed very smarmy and gossipy and not flattering to the people, but very flattering to himself.
Of course. And these are the same people that he has put in his clique. So the clique is turning on him.
Well, and one patriarch said, oh, poor McAllister, what a pity it is he wrote a book. And just the cap on the thing, he was, you know, he was in the papers too much already for the old guard to tolerate. And he used to send updates to the newspapers from Newport, which is the retreat. You know? Come on.
It's our sanctuary!
And then he became suspected of taking bribes for invitations to the patriarchs and the family dancing group. People couldn't stand it.
He's kind of tossed on his
Yeah, he had no suspicion that he was making this continental laughingstock of himself with this book. Mm-hmm. He thought it was just a wonderful...
Yeah, he thought it was... Yeah, in his head, this was brilliant. And he lost his brilliance.
So Mrs. Astor largely just allowed him to be cast off, really. She supported him for, you know, maybe a couple more balls, but the attendance really dropped off, and she let him fade away. So ultimately, it was she in that relationship that had the power. He was her servant.
Right.
Yeah.
It was questionable before, but now it's pretty obvious.
She replaced him with someone that they called the fun maker, Harry Lair, which is, he is like a dirty character. I'm telling you what. He married a girl just for her money. He pretended to be in love with her, and the day of their wedding said, "I hate women. I hate all women. And I especially hate you."
Nice.
I'm like, Merry Christmas. Yeah. And so she stayed in a marriage with him for 28 years rather than get divorced. But luckily, it ends well for her. She marries titled British nobility.
Ah.
So ultimately, but I feel very sorry for her.
That's
for 28
a long time.
Years. So I'm prejudiced against the fun maker. Yeah. He might be the fun maker, but he is also the agita maker for his poor wife. I don't like that.
Nope.
So another milestone appears very soon. So after the break, we will tell you about the birth of the Mrs. Astor.
Au vache, coq ou cheval, jusqu'à la porte un violon, homme chanteur, un seul oiseau, dansera gil avec sa femme, couple trempé dans son printemps. Lors de l'herbe, le plomb du ciel, séparé par les flammes bleues, de la santé, de la rosée. Le sang s'irrite, le cœur tarde, le couple, le premier, le flair.
And welcome back. Let's talk about the Mrs. Astor. She's called the Mrs. Astor, but why? According to the rules of primogeniture, she should not be the Mrs. Astor. That should be her nephew's wife, who is living next door to her in New York. But she wants the title, so she takes it.
William, her nephew, instructs the post office in Newport to anything that comes from Mrs. Astor, direct to my wife. Well, the postmaster in Newport, knowing full well what side his bread is buttered on, mm-hmm. continues to deliver the Mrs. Astor mail to Caroline Astor.
Which is really infuriating the William, the nephew's family.
And the press inflames this to the point where it embarrasses William Waldorf Astor.
Mm-hmm.
It makes him so furious because society is not going along with his wishes and is sticking to his aunt. And his aunt rubs him the wrong way anyway.
Oh, families have never been close.
No.
We've talked about that.
And so, you know, this, not just the name thing, but just basically the whole of society irritates the crap out of him. And he pulls up stakes and goes to England.
Which is a fine place to go. Because Mrs. Astor does not approve of
and she
England.
Yeah, and so she's not going to be there, and he's getting away from her. And you know, he...
Actually fares very well in England.
He ended up buying himself, through effort and money, several titles, the highest of which was Viscount Astor. And in a 6 degrees of cool separation thing, he bought and restored Hever Castle, which is Anne Boleyn's birthplace.
Cool!
Anne Boleyn, the second wife of the famous, infamous Henry VIII.
Who we are not talking about this week.
No.
But we are, they're on the list, so, you know, you can keep telling us to talk about them, and we will someday.
So here he is in England, and, you know, with no plans to come back, so what does he do to his aunt?
He rips down his house and builds a hotel next to her mansion. Well, this is not faring well for her. She's looking at the back of his hotel.
There's no windows. We've got a picture we'll have to show you. She doesn't even get to look at the people coming in and out or the fanciness. No, she's got a blank wall. It's the blank wall, the garden, which now is full of shadow and probably everything's dead.
Dead.
And her house.
Right.
And so she and her son construct this plan. Well, we're going to make a livery stable so everything stinks.
Won't your guests like that at
the
Waldorf?
And so her son convinces her. Let's go ahead and I've got this lovely house we're constructing up the street. Mm-hmm. Let's all move there and get away from this, what she called a glorified tavern. There's a glorified tavern next door, she'd say. Which is
nice.
Hilarious.
Very nice.
It's like the most fancy,
glorified tavern.
Well thought of hotel, you know.
It's the Waldorf. So what else? Now, the Bowery Boys obviously go into greater detail about this on their podcast, about the history of the Waldorf Astoria.
Yeah.
But basically, at this point, her son and Caroline ripped down her mansion and built the Astoria right next door.
Yep, and in between, there is a lovely place to show your wealth and for the husbands to parade their wealth upon the necks and earrings of their wives,
mm-hmm.
called Peacock Alley, which reminds me of the Hall of Mirrors, because I think that was constructed so that people would be able to parade and show off their things to mm-hmm. everyone. And so Peacock Alley was kind of the same thing. And so Mrs. Astor, down at her new digs, which she shares with her son, it's a completely separate house, except at the back they share a ballroom, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
That's actually really good living arrangements. I would like to live with my mother-in-law that way.
Yeah.
Sharing a ballroom.
And so Mrs. Astor, at this point, started to model herself. She's 61, and it's completely obvious to me from this point in history that she was modeling herself after Queen Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
She had a persona of a benevolent monarch. Her livery of her servants was modeled after Windsor Castle's livery. She had crests put on her all her linens. The women were required to wear tiaras in her ballroom.
Okay, now I want to go.
Yes.
I would love to be required to wear a tiara.
So, she was actually, during this period, known for her dignified attentiveness, and not one person could remember anything she actually said.
No, but she has a profession, of sorts, she's a professional hostess.
She is, and she has this thing where she has this red velvet divan up on a dais, uh-huh. you know, and if you were favored, Mrs. Astor would signal to one of her people standing near, which sounds like a lady-in-waiting to me.
Oh, totally.
Signal to one of her ladies-in-waiting, which weren't called that, but to come fetch you and bring you to the lap of the queen, basically, for her to speak to you. And then
thrill it would be to go to visit Mrs. Astor at the divan.
And then everyone knew.
And she also has this portrait of herself where she greets people as they come in. It's this ginormous thing, and she stands below it, and of course we'll give you a picture of that, but
she did not approve of photography, by the way. There's not that many pictures
there
of
is
Mrs.
not
Astor.
It's really hard, and there's one to her side. She wasn't a beautiful woman, but she wasn't, I mean, she was very sturdy looking, I guess is a good way to put it.
She had said that she wanted to rule over a contented realm and hoped everyone would behave properly, dress well, and enjoy her hospitality and take pleasure in her supremacy. If that doesn't sound like some kind of queen.
Oh, I don't know what is.
Okay, now, this rival, another rival, take two, although not really new money, Mamie Fish, unfortunate name, but very old family.
Mm-hmm. Mamie Stuyvesant Fish.
Stuyvesant?
I just like saying Stuyvesant.
Yeah, that's, in fact, she's an older family than the Skirmerhorns, mm-hmm. but she was witty and always, her parties were full of gossip and intellectuals, and Ward McAllister had been taken up by her a little bit as he got dropped by everyone else. He was very useful.
Mm-hmm. And he knew the rules.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
But Mrs. Astor just kept inviting her and vaguely smiling and was notably unaffected by anything Mamie Fish did, and that automatically made her still seem superior.
Uh-huh.
Like, feel free to dance about Mamie Fish with all your ridiculous notions, but here I am smiling on you. Oh, yes, Mamie Fish. Whatever. Yeah, it's so funny. And so Mrs. Astor, toward the end, when she was a professional hostess and had 600 to 2,200 guests in her house all the time, would receive under that great famous portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone was received. She would nod, look about, and go to bed.
Go to bed. She did her thing.
Her daughters were there. They could handle it.
Absolutely.
The staff knew what they were doing. There was nothing to be concerned about.
And she'd been to this party before a few hundred times.
So she just would go to bed, which seems kind of cute. I don't know.
It is. And I actually, she softens later in her life.
She does.
Her daughter Charlotte has gone off and had an affair on her husband and has to be hauled back from Europe. And according to the rules of society that Mrs. Astor had put in play, her daughter should be pretty shunned at this point. But no. It is her daughter, and she's got her back. And so who is standing under the portrait, greeting the guests, accept her back into society? Because Mrs. Astor basically is saying, yeah, accept
you
her.
You will, yeah. And interesting, Charlotte was the only daughter that had an arranged marriage. The other three daughters married for love. The mm-hmm. first two got away from her, I think. They got married, woo, before.
Yeah.
Whoa, the parents. And so they determined they were going to handle Charlotte's. And then Charlotte turned out so bad that Carrie was allowed, we'll talk about this in the next podcast, to marry someone they completely disapproved of, but they allowed because she was in love and they didn't want Charlotte's thing to happen again.
Right.
And, you know. Yeah. And also, one of the society women who had fallen on a little hard times was very enterprising and opened a tea room. So she's in trade,
mm-hmm.
and Mrs. Astor purposely took people there and patronized the tea room and made it very fashionable and acceptable to be in. So she supported people that were her friends.
So she's softening.
Yeah.
No, there's no doubt about that. Unfortunately, at the peak of her softening, she kind of goes a little crazy. She's really overcome by dementia later in life and is living, you know, with her son. Mm-hmm. And planning balls that no one will ever attend, and writing out the invitations, and planning the menus, and driving down the street and waving.
At no one.
At nobody. And talking and greeting people who aren't there.
Yeah, her house was filled in the evenings with callers and conversation, but there was nobody there.
It's kind of sad.
And all those fancy invitations she wrote, her secretary would listen attentively, write out all the things, and then they would be put in a drawer or thrown away in the fire. They never got delivered. And then she would go shopping, and upon orders of her son, the merchants were to pretend that these were real orders and write them down, and then they were to rip out the order and just simply throw it away.
And it says a lot about her that they did that.
Yeah.
The merchants all did that.
It was a kindness, I think, just to, not to call attention.
Because she's given so much to their businesses over the years that it's just good customer service.
Oh. So, at a clear moment, though, this is what she hoped for herself, for her memory. She had hoped that her reputation would be of dignity, while the current seekers of notoriety were no gentlewomen. She hoped she would be remembered for the dignity of her life.
I think she's dignified, yes.
Yeah, I'm still reminded of this picture that I see, though, that it's called After the Ball, and it's a lady, a girl, young girl, who's obviously not been invited, and she's reading the newspaper, and she looks so wistful and sad, and I just keep thinking about all those innocent people that were just shunned for no apparent reason other than the whim of these two people.
True. I agree.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say that I think that creating a group of people that understand you and surrounding yourself with them is actually something that a lot of us do.
Right.
We don't speak our minds freely with groups of people that we know aren't going to get what we're saying.
That's true.
So I think that was part of what her and Ward were doing, in a way grander scale. And yes, they did shun people out, but I think it was kind of human.
Yeah, I think you're
in some regards. Well, finally, she's had a stroke, she's left society, and finally in 1908, at the age of 78, Caroline dies. You can still view her remains are interred at Trinity Church in New York City, and there is a
cenotaph.
Thank you. There is a cenotaph.
Or obelisk.
In her honor. And, of course, we'll link you to that. Because there's a really cool website, Find a Grave. I don't know if anyone's ever looked at that. It's just kind of fun-ish in a creepy sort of way to go through that. So that's pretty cool. So Caroline passes away. 4 years later, her son, John Jacob Astor, goes down on the Titanic, which is kind of a famous death tied to that family. Her husband dies of an aneurysm in Paris. Very sad. And society is left without any queen to regulate it. So what happens?
The society really does fall apart into little kingdoms, and it took three women to replace her as queen, but even together they never achieved one society. So you've got the formerly mentioned Alva Vanderbilt, she of the fancy French chateau. We've got Mamie Fish, the witty person who stole Ward McAllister once he was dropped, and then Tessie Ulrichs, who her most memorable thing to me is she had these planters outside of her house that was modeled after a French chateau of Marie Antoinette's, and she used to use them for target practice.
Nice.
So you know Mrs. Astor's not going to love
that. No, that's
that.
Not her kind of people at all.
Well, we'll cover them more extensively in a future podcast. The parties get kooky.
Crazy. They're not the dignified.
No.
But they have a hint of fun.
They do have a hint of fun. The pie girl dinner where canaries and nightingales and a nudie come out of a pie on the middle of the dinner table.
Can you imagine Mrs. Astor seeing a nudie come out of a pie?
Oh my goodness.
Yikes!
Would you eat that pie after?
I know.
I don't think I would.
Not
with all those birds in there. Yuck. And so, Mamie Fish had some clever ones. She had elephants and chimpanzees at a lot of her parties, and then she also invited all of society to meet the Prince Del Drago. And oh my goodness, did everyone flock to meet the Prince Del Drago, who ended up being a dress-up monkey.
Nice.
So, psych. And then also she and Ward McAllister thought it was totally funny to set a little dog covered with flour in the middle of a dinner party or the middle of a ballroom and just watch the hijinks as he ruined everyone's dresses on the way by. That does not sound very dignified to me.
It's like a frat party with money.
Mm-mm-mm. And also, okay, here's one connection. Edith Wharton, famous Edith Wharton, who wrote a book called The Age of Innocence about old New York. Her father and Mrs. Astor were first cousins. And I have to recommend that movie, The Age of Innocence.
Yes.
Although Winona Ryder is woefully miscast.
You think so?
Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll have to do that as a special feature. But yeah, no good. The costumery, fabulous.
Yes. Yes.
It's quite lovely. And also, if you are a fan of Marilyn Monroe, there is a reference to the 400 in the movie Some Like It Hot, which seems totally weird.
Very random.
So the quote from Marilyn Monroe is, "Daddy threatened to cut me off without a cent. It was such a bore. Coming out, parties, cotillions, always the same 400.
Very nice.
And then I have to give a couple of books that I totally recommend here. Mrs. Astor's New York by Eric Hollenberger. Is quite lovely, and it'll give you the details. It's got photographs, all kinds of things for you. And even better is a book called Displaying Women, Spectacles of Leisure in Edith Wharton's New York by Maureen Montgomery. So if you're going to pick up two books, those are the ones that I recommend. And then the only other movie that really fits my time period that I like, there's a whole bunch of westerns. And that's not what we're looking for.
No.
I mean, it is same time period, yes. But that's, you know...
And it's so funny to think that... Laura Ingalls Wilder is living at the same time as Caroline Astor.
And Helen Keller.
And Helen Keller.
We're in a bit of a rut here with the time period. That's okay. So there is another, just look at it for the costume. It's a Henry James novel, and I'm not too fond of this movie, but it's good for costumes, called The Golden Bowl, and it's got Uma Thurman in it. And
oh, love her.
It has got Mr. Knightley from Emma in it, too. Jeremy Northam.
Ooh.
The beautiful people are in this movie with beautiful costumes. That's all I have to say about that. You can put it on mute, most likely, and you'd be fine.
Just have it going in the background while you have your ball.
Yes.
On your large screen TV in your ballroom, and then let a dog run around with flowers.
No, this is a little bit later. A little bit later, the Titanic movie is, you know, set in 1912, which is outside of our period. However, if you look at some of the older ladies, you're going to see, you know, how ladies don't always keep up with the current fashions. And Rose's mother is sort of, you know, more Gilded Age dressed. And, you know, you can catch a glimpse of the John Jacob Astor character, the son.
The son.
Of Mrs. Astor.
Yes.
For fashion, go to fashion-era.com. They've got all kinds of eras there, but click on late Victorian fashion, and that's the Gilded Age is what you're going to find. Or honestly, just Google Charles Worth and hit images. Because it is...
Some of those gowns are astonishing. It's amazing.
We actually have a cool link. Carrie, the daughter with the electric fire on her head, the electric star on her head, her two sons donated to the Metropolitan Museum of Art two of her ball dresses, her actual ball dresses, Mrs. Astor's daughter, and they are in the collection, and we'll post a picture of them online.
They're beautiful.
So, what the young ladies would be wearing.
Right. Yes, they're beautiful. So, what have you taken away from Mrs. Astor?
Caroline Astor, the Mrs. Astor. Was the ruler of society, the queen of America, for a few short decades. And society's never been the same again, and I think we've seen the last of the great queens of society in America. Well, thank you for listening. See you next time.
Bye!
For show notes and links to the things we talked about today, please visit us at thehistorychicks.com. Follow us on Twitter at thehistorychicks.
With an X.
Or like us on Facebook without an X. If you'd like to sin real life, please tell a few friends or leave a review for us on iTunes.
The music in our podcast comes courtesy of Music Alley. Visit them at music.mevio.com.